Trey, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Trey.
And our speaker tonight comes from my home group, instrumental woman in our group. Very in the program, very service oriented. With that, I give you Aaron Garland.
Yeah.
Just kidding. No, seriously, it's a woman that inspires me every day. I'm Trey, I'm an alcoholic. If I didn't say that, I'm going to make sure that I know that anyway, if y'all don't. You know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous just wanting to put down the drink, and you know, God puts a whole lot more in our life when we do this program, as outlined in the first 164 pages. I did it all kinds of ways, coming in and out, but you know, God had another wife for me. I didn't think I was going to get married again. I sure wasn't looking for it. And this woman inspires me every day. I look up to her. She's my wife, and I'm her biggest fan. And if anybody, I don't know if anybody remembers the Memorex commercials. I always say it like this, because you know that dude sitting on that chair, and there's a big speaker, and it's blowing his hair back, and he's sitting there, and the damn lamp's coming off of the table, and this is what her talk's like, man. It's awesome. It's like riding a roller coaster you never thought you were going to get on, and it's awesome. With that, I give you my wife, Katie.
All right.
He builds it up way too much. Yeah, I don't need my coffee. No, I don't know if it's going to be as exciting. But anyway, I'm Katie Hillman, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
everybody. My sobriety date is July 12th, 2009, so I have a little over 7 years. I have a home group, and I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor women. So guidelines tell me I'm supposed to tell you a little bit what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And so that's what I'm going to try to do, and tell you how I recovered from alcoholism through finding a power greater than myself. So I'm from Atlanta, born and raised. I live over inside the perimeter off Barcliff Road, and I went to elementary school at Oak Grove, and I went to high school at Lakeside, and I still live in that area, and my home group meets where I went to kindergarten. And so I was, you know, 50 years ago or 49 years ago, I was in kindergarten at this place, and now I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous there. So it's kind of bizarre. But I'm the third child of three, and my parents were married for 36 years, and so I was given all the opportunities that, you know, I could have possibly wanted to turn out normal. I didn't know really what a normal life was. I will say my dad's an alcoholic, so, you know, that has its own, you know, characteristics in that. I played sports probably alcoholically all growing up. I'd say that was the one thing I did. I was like very involved in softball. I played on five teams, and I did gymnastics, and I swam and I dove and I cheerleaded. I just did stuff, you know, all the time, and I was really never at home that much. But I don't remember that much of my childhood. A lot of my friends say maybe I drank too much, might have like wet brain. I have no idea, but I don't remember that much. I remember that, you know, I had loving parents, and I, you know, went to good schools, and I was provided everything I needed. And my sister was a bit of a partier. She was the kind of girl that, you know, had the smoking permit at Lakeside, and she just hung out with the smoking crowd, you know. And this was, she graduated in 76, so this is in, like, you know, 1968 to 76. And, you know, I was born in 65, so, you know, I knew what all kinds of drugs were and things like that, especially what she was doing, probably at the age of 9 or 10. It was kind of like, you know, my sister kind of went overboard, actually, and she got picked up when I was 9 or 10, and she got picked up doing LSD. She was walking, actually, down, I never tell this, but it's just funny how things like this just sort of like, oh, okay, we deal with it, and then we go on. You know, it didn't seem like a big deal. But, like, way back then, they were doing, I guess, these kind of drugs, and, like, she was doing LSD and all this stuff, and somehow she was all fried up, and she was walking down the highway, and she had, like, a head of lettuce on her head. And I remember that she got picked up, and they took her to West Paces Ferry Mental Institution, and we came back home, and my mom and dad were going going through all of her stuff on the dryer. I remember that. And my brother and me were like, oh, no, she's going to be so busted. And there was like, you know, there was the pipes and the drugs and all that kind of stuff there. And I remember thinking, I am never going to be like that, you know. And my brother was a great guy. He was 4 years older than me, and she was 4 years older than him. And he always wanted the best for me. So he would help me, like, he was like, you know, because he was kind of quiet and shy and just nobody knew him in high school. And he was like, you know, you need to be, I was a gymnast, and he was like, you need to be a cheerleader and you need to do this stuff. And he really helped me get in with a good crowd and things go well for me. And he was great for me. And I remember he was, you know, but we had these cousins that partied all the time. So I sort of lived the double life that they talk about in the big book. You know, I was a cheerleader and I dated a quarterback and I was in kind of the good crowd. But then on the weekends and especially summers and Christmases and all that kind of stuff, I would you know, get high with my cousins. And I mean, at a young age, like 7th grade, 8th grade, I was just, you know, getting high and doing that kind of stuff. But I never wanted to cause my parents the problems that I saw my sister cause them. And we used to have to go. I remember. We would have to go twice a week up to see her at that institution, and everybody, my mom and dad, would be like, "Don't, you know, you don't tell anybody. You don't tell anybody what's going on in the family." And you know, we didn't, because I was like, I didn't want that to be out, you know. But I remember her being like in solitary confinement and her screaming and it not going good. And there's some problems in my sister's life now. And you know, this kind of makes me, I've never thought this, but I should be more loving and tolerant of it, because you know, my parents always thought maybe they gave her too much stuff way back then, because she was literally like, I think like shock treatment and all that kind of stuff. And I remember several times her screaming in the constant solitary confinement and them saying we can't see her that night. It was really all due to drugs and stuff. And so I was a very good kid up until through high school. I was sort of the good kid. You know, my brother was quiet and shy. He left. I was left with my parents, and you know, I was a cheerleader, so they were coming to the games, and they were working the concession stands at softball and gymnastics, and had a bunch of friends, and things were really good. I had wonderful high school years. I loved high school. I do remember my senior year, though. I was me and my best friend. I had this best friend that you know, wasn't popular. She was more of the drinking thing, and so I had all that going on still. And so, like, we would go and you know, drink beers. Like, we would smoke pot and drink beers before school, and we'd put a hole in the can and open the thing and down it. We do like 3 of those beers and smoke pot before school at Lakeside, you know. And then I'd walk into my cheerleading outfit, and my little French braid, and smiling and, you know, acting like everything's normal, and got away with it. And I didn't have any consequences until, you know, later. I will say that I never studied in school, and I'm not a very smart person, I don't think. I've tried later in years to learn and read and do things like that, but generally speaking, I kind of was kind of the loud kid that got in trouble, and I just cheated, and I made my way because I was a cute little kid. I mean, I was cute. I had blonde hair, and I had these big teeth, but, you know, they looked like bunny rabbit teeth, but the face was the same, and I got away with just almost anything, and I was real skinny. They call me Twig, and I just, you know, I just got away with everything, and I never ever studied, and I cheated all my way through high school. So when I got to college, I really had nothing else to do but cheat. So I went to the University of Georgia, and I got in on special studies, and which means that your schooling doesn't count until you pass, and you have to pass within four quarters, or you're kicked out permanently. And when I took the SAT to get in Georgia, I cheated. And the reason why they know I cheated was because I cheated off the wrong test. There's 2 tests, and I made like at the time, I think a 1600 was the best you can get or something like that. I scored like a 1560 on the wrong test. And so they called my parents, and it was kind of a bad situation. And they said, you know, they pleaded, and they said, let her take it again. So I took it again, and I just did horrible. So I got in special studies at the University of Georgia. And I didn't pass anything till the 4th quarter, and then I started cheating, and I got like C's, I got straight C's, and so I got in after the 4th quarter. My parents spent all that money, and I got in. So I was a student after a year and a half, and right about that time, my parents were going through a divorce. My dad was drinking heavily a lot, and he had been let go of his job, and he was sort of a very prominent businessman in Atlanta, and he, you know, was an orator. Actually, he was. He was the president of the credit union leagues for all of the Southeast. And so he knew a lot of politicians. He did a lot of talks, and drinking just caught up with him. And he was let go, and, you know, and, And my mom started checking all the, you know, the car and the house, and she was marking bottles, and they were going, like, she kept coming to me saying, you know, why has his liquor bottle got more in it than it did yesterday? And I'd say, because he drank that bottle and he's got a new one, you know. But I'm like, my mom, we're like, duh. I mean, you know, she didn't get it at all. And so he just drank. So my mom ended up saying, you know, I'm going to leave you if you don't divorce me. So my dad was like, hell yeah, you know, I can just drink all the time now. So they divorced after 36 years of marriage, and I was in college, and dad had, you know, there was no more money left, so I was on loans, and I ended up getting caught cheating a couple times. And so anyway, I failed out of Georgia, and I moved in with a drug dealer. Wasn't that smart? And so I started partying really bad. My 20s were awful, and I mean, I was working down at Little Five Point, and I was you know, selling like just little baggies of cocaine. I mean, this is in like the mid 80s, and my life was a mess. I mean, I was working in the morning, I was drinking all the time. I was, you know, I ended up, you know, getting in bad shape, and I got down to about 95 pounds, 96 pounds. I weigh like 116 now, so you're talking about 20 pounds less than this. I mean, nose running all the time, and I was just horrible. And I was at Backstreets all night, and my life just got really, really bad. I mean, it was, those 80s were just, they were awful. And so, I ended up getting a DUI at college before I left. When I failed out, I tried to take it Georgia State, couldn't do that, so I gave up school. And so I was just waitressing and partying. That's all I did. I was just partying, you know. And people in here tonight that are in the 20s and 30s, you know, that's what I did in my early 20s so badly. And so I ended up getting, let's see, I got DUI in college. And so then in 1992, I got a DUI I was playing softball at the Softball Country Club, and I left, and I was going to Backstreets, and I had gotten really, really drunk. And I was in the car with somebody else, and we got pulled over, and she took her backpack and took off, and I got the first DUI, and I went to jail. And that was my second one, because I got one in college, which that one's even funnier. I'll tell that story, because this is a long time. Usually they read till 9:15, and then you got to end. So, yeah, so my very first one was kind of funny. I didn't have a car in college, because I was a mess, and my brother and sister had wrecked all these cars, so my parents were like, we're not giving this girl a car. So I didn't have a car, but I got my first DUI. So I was, there was a bunch of us, we all went out, and we had dropped some acid, and we were partying, and so I'm, you know, and so anyway, I get pulled over driving somebody else's car, this big, huge car that was humongous. So there's like six of us in the car, and I go, listen, everybody, I have read that if everybody says nobody was driving and the keys are on the floor of the back seat, nobody will get a DUI. I'm like, you guys got it? I'm like, nobody was driving, you know, because I'm getting pulled over, you know. And also, cop comes up the car, and everybody say, you know, nobody say anything. And then finally, he goes, who was driving? And literally, they all went, her. And I mean, you know, I was just like, man, y'all, that sucks so bad. So that was my first DUI at the University of Georgia. I went, and it was just such a bad situation. My best friend Jennifer loves this part of it. I used to live up on a hill, and I used to drive a skateboard. And so right before that DUI, I had crashed on my skateboard, and I had tried to do like a 180 on my skateboard because a car was coming, and I was tripping. And so I thought a car was coming at me, so I did this 180, and I splat all over my driveway. And so I had this chin that was so long and over to the side, and it was like purple and blue. And so my very first DUI, when I got my picture taken, you know, in my mugshot, I had this long purple chin, and I was all bruised up. And I remember the cop saying, you know, are you in an abusive relationship? And I was just like, you know, no, you know. And I remember saying, no, but why is my name up there three times? And he was like, your name's not up there three times. But I was like tripping, so I was like seeing things, and I was just like, oh, get me out of here. And I got out, and my best friend Jennifer was there with a bunch of people, and we started drinking again. And I woke up the next morning, and I went to school, and I acted like it never happened. And I always felt like that if nobody knew, if I didn't tell anybody what happened and I fixed it, then it didn't really happen, you know? And I remember that very first time I didn't tell my parents about any of them, but I went to the judge in Athens, and I said, you know, I have no family, and I don't have no money, and you know, I can't. And I started working at this topless bar. I was a waitress, but there was the topless girls were dancing at on Atlanta Highway when you first go into Athens. I was working there, this cowboy bar. It was terrible, and I was living in my sorority house. This is so double how my life was: living in my sorority house, acting like a normal girl, yet I'm working at the topless joint to raise money for my DUI while I'm in college. And so anyway, I I get the money, and they tell me that I'm found guilty. And I said, that's bullshit to the judge. I said, you know, that is, you know, crap. How do you know that? And he said, because, you know, I am the court. And I remember I was just so trashy and so just such a drunk, you know. I was like, well, that's bullshit. And I had 331s in a Crown Royal bag, and I threw it up onto the desk. And my lawyer, and I had a court-appointed lawyer, because I told him I was indigent and broke and all this stuff. And he, like, dragged me out of there, and it was just, that was just, like, in my behavior. I was just so, like, you know, just entitled and just stupid. And so fast forward to 92, I got my first DUI November 4th, 1992, which was when President Clinton was voted to become president. Is that right? Yeah. That was my second one. And so I started working two jobs because I was going to fix this, and I got a job at Circuit City and La Peep and my first signed job. And 20 days later, I got my third DUI on Cheshire Bridge Road. I was leaving a bar there, and I was going to back streets, and I got pulled over again. And I remember the guy took me to Georgia Tech, pulled me over. I said, I'm not drunk. He said, you know, I'm a brand new cop. You're on camera. You're going to jail. And I said, look, I can do a backflip on this line. And he didn't care. He liked me. He took me to Georgia Tech, made me do a blood test. I don't know why I went to Georgia Tech. It was so weird back then. And then I went to jail. I went to the same jail that I told him 2 weeks before I needed to plead NOLO because I had no family and nobody to help me. And now I couldn't get out NOLO because I, you know, and so I ended up, of course, calling my brother and my cousin and family, you know, brilliantly appeared. And I lost my license, and I went to a women's prison for 9 days, and none of that stopped me drinking, none of it. I drove on a suspended license. I was just like, you know, I got to get money, I got to get the stuff paid for, I got, you know, and it didn't even dawn on me that I had a drinking problem. And things got progressively worse, and I started doing all these things that, you know, I do when I drink and I am out of my head. I was waking up next to people I didn't know. I was... I woke up several mornings, and I remember looking outside and saying, "Oh, thank God, my car's out there." And it was terrifying. You know, I mean, it was terrifying because, you know, deep down in my gut, I knew that wasn't right, and I knew that wasn't how, you know, that I was supposed to be living, and that I could have hurt somebody. And that's several times. And one time, we even went looking for my car because I told everybody it was stolen. And then as the day progressed, I started saying, "You know, I might have been at this other bar, and we found my car at a bar." That was like normal behavior, you know. And so around 1995, things got really bad, and I remember everybody close to me was pulling away, and someone said, you know, what they said to me, which meant so much, is they said, one person said, you know that mirror you bought? The mirror still hangs in my bedroom. When you first come out of bedroom, there's this little mirror right here, and it has this gold thing around it. It was the first nice thing I'd bought myself, and I bought it for myself in 1995. I'd just been moving to sales at this nice sign job, and my friend looked at me, and she said, you know what? She said, you know, you don't need to look at that frame around that mirror. She goes, you are so sick. You need to look in the mirror. You are sick and you are hopeless. And she, I don't want to be around you. And I remember saying, fine, I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because my sister and brother were in it. And I don't need you in my life and any of y'all people because I had nobody else. And I was desperate. And it was a mess. And I mean, I was counting the days of when I could get another DUI. I was like, I have to go 4 more years and 6 months before I could get a third one or a fourth one, but 3 and 5 years. And my life was a wreck. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1995. It was April 22nd, 1995, and I stayed sober for 8 years. And my life got incredible. I was only 27, 28 years old. I mean, you know, from 20 to 27, I was an absolute wreck. I mean, a drunk, a sloppy, nasty, mean drunk that would snort anything, take anything. You know, it didn't matter as long as it, you know, got me messed up. I thought life was a party, and it was all about me. And I just, you know, just seemed normal. So I got sober, and life got really good. I mean, I started, you know, they say half measures availed us nothing. What they mean is, to me, what that means is it availed me a lot of stuff. It did not keep me sober long term, and I ended up going back out, and then I crossed all the lines I said I would never, and my life became incredibly horrible. But for those first 8 years, I mean, when you take away all the drugs and alcohol from me, you know, I'm not out sleeping with people I don't know. I'm not out drunk driving, getting DUIs. You know, I never got a DUI that whole time when I was sober. I never got pulled over, never scared of the cops, never went to jail. Had been in jail so many times. I mean, like at least 4 times besides the women's prison. And so life got pretty good. I I bought my first house. I bought, you know, a real nice car. You know, people were wanting to hang around me again. I was traveling, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, it went really, really well. I became top sales at my company. My ego was getting huge. I was forgetting that it was God doing this stuff for me and that God gave me this job to begin with. It was like, I thought it was all about me. I mean, I used to come in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. It's embarrassing. Now when I go to NABA and stuff, I feel bad, but I remember being in meetings at places and saying things like, you know, I don't understand why people relapse. It's like a game. You win or you lose. You're either a winner and you stay sober, or you're a fucking loser and you drink again. Excuse my language. I'm so sorry. And you know, I was that belligerent and that awful, you know, and I really felt like that was it. Like, why can't you just do it on self-will? I had never gone through the book, and I didn't know about all the stuff. Like, now I've gone through that book so many times. I mean, I had to go through the book probably 40 times, once with a sponsor, and then like 39 more times with sponsees, till I understand it now, and I understand that I could not, you know, I wasn't keeping myself sober, and I could, with all my power, I could not stay sober. I was beyond human aid, and I was going to drink again no matter what. But life got so good for a while, and I surrounded myself with Alcoholics Anonymous people, and I went to meetings all the time. I was a meeting maker, is totally, and all my people were in AA, and I didn't put it in my body. So the first step I had, I wasn't drinking or using. So my life was a lot better. However, I became 35 and I started thinking, you know, I made too much about that Alcoholics Anonymous thing. I was like, you can't be an alcoholic at 27. I was like, you know, it's kind of stupid, isn't it? I mean, aren't alcoholics under a bridge and they don't have, you know, brand new Mercedes, and they don't live in houses like this, and whatever. You know, I mean, my mind was so screwed up, and I thought I was doing it all, and I thought, you know what, I cannot be an alcoholic. This is insane. And I didn't have the program I have now. I didn't have the people around me. I didn't even have the knowledge, which won't keep me sober, but I didn't even know that if I drank again, I would not be able to get sober again. You know, there's a chance that I would never be able to get sober again, and that I was going to get right back where I was. I thought that I was going to get, I gained power over it again. And so I started drinking, and the first night I had just a couple out of some work event, came home. Roommates didn't notice. See, you know, I'm not an alcoholic, you know. Within like a week or two, though, I had drank to a blackout. And I knew deep down in here, I knew there was a problem. But it was too late. I couldn't do anything about it. And I was so full of shame and remorse. And I couldn't go back to Alcoholics Anonymous and to those people that I had said, you know, winner or loser. I was like that Charlie Sheen, you know, winning. I mean, I was like so off my, you know, off my rocker. I just was so, I'm seriously was like that. I was like, you know, I would like judge everything, you know, like I'm better, you know, like, and or whatever. And I couldn't really go back there, and my soul was just eaten up with it and with that, as well as the fact that I couldn't stop drinking, you know. So it turned out for like a couple years or whatever, you know, I just went downhill really, really fast, and I started doing all the things. Like, I ended up going to Peachford over alcohol poisoning. I went to a long-term treatment facility for 4 months. You know, I just did crazy things. Like, I was started taking muscle relaxers, and drinking never left me. I was always a drinker. I even was a morning drinker. But I would, as you know, people, my parents and them were on to me now because Dad had gotten sober. My sister had gotten sober. They all were like, you know, and you can tell when I'm drinking. I mean, you know, when anybody's drinking, you know, we think we get away with it, but it's so stupid. You know, when the family's like, you know, you seem like you've been drinking tonight, you know. I mean, you know, we all do that. We lie. No, I haven't had any, you know. And then they come over to your house and you're asleep in your front yard, you know. I mean, I that is what happened one time on Somas. And another time I tried to get in my house. Those are like heavy-duty muscle relaxers. And I couldn't get the key in because your brain won't make your muscles work when you're on heavy-duty muscle relaxers. So I could not make the key go in. I was trying to will it like we do stop drinking. I was like, go in there. Go in there. Finally, I just gave up, went and slept in my front yard. And my neighbors came and found me. And they were like, you know, they came. They're still my neighbors. And they came and they got me up. And they're like, you know, it's a decent neighborhood. And they got me up. They're like, you know, what? Come on. You need to go to your house. And I'm like, I can't get my key in the door. And they're like, you know, what is wrong with you? You know, I mean, they don't understand because I'm not powerless over alcohol, you know. And they helped me get in. And then another time, I helped myself to their liquor cabinet, and I was caught on camera. They're my next-door neighbors. I had to make amends for that because I didn't know they had gotten this new alarm system. I was always welcome to come in their house, and then they were out of town this time, but they didn't tell me to come walk their dog this time. But I needed some alcohol, and it was Sunday, and they didn't have it in Atlanta on Sundays then. And so I thought, well, I'll just get some from them. So I went into their house using a key, and the alarm goes off, and I'm like, holy cow, when did they get this alarm, you know? And so I grabbed the Grey Goose, and I poured a big tumbler of it, and I downed it really fast because it's so, like, I downed a huge tumbler of this Grey Goose, and then I put it back, and I ran to my house. Well, by then, the phone's ringing, and they're like, you know, yes, you're on the security system for the house next door. The alarm's going off. Do you know anything going on? I'm like, oh, it's fine. I'm like, you know, I was just over there. Everything's fine. And this, it's like 9 on a Sunday morning, 9 in the morning. Everything's fine. So the neighbors call me, and they go, our alarm's going off. Do you know anything? I said, everything's fine over there. No problem. And so about an hour later, my brother found me in my room, and he said my, you know, pupils were, you know, blue or something. I don't know what it was, but I was in an alcoholic overdose coma, and I got rushed to the hospital, and I was there until about 11:30 at night, and I woke up, and my old elderly mom was looking over the thing, and she was just like, what's happened to my baby? When are you going to stop this? And that was like 4 days after treatment, you know. I mean, it doesn't, you know, I mean, till I was, you know, beaten up enough, and I was ready to do what's, you know, recommended in this, and alcohol synopsis, I could not get sober. And I mean, I did that for years. I mean, I did so many things like that. I mean, those are just two examples, but there were just so many. And so toward the end, some of the latter things that happened before I got sober this last time was I've been at my job for 25 years. I started in 1992, so I guess I'm coming up on 25 years. And they saw me grow up. You know, I was 26 years old when I started there, and they saw me grow up. And so, and they're very compassionate people. And they knew I'd been drinking again. First, they knew I lost my license because I'm taking a taxi to work. And, you know, and then I was a sales manager at the time, so I'm having my brother drive me around, and I'm training people. I have no car. And so they knew some things were wrong. They realized I'd started drinking again, but I told them I was going to, you know, get sober and do different this time. So one week, I woke up in the morning, and I started drinking, and I was like, I can't go in today. So I called my boss, and I said, Craig, I'm not going to be able to come in today. I'm sick, but if I get better, I'll come in later. And he said, okay. So the next day, I woke up, did the exact same thing, called him, I'm sick, I'm probably going to be in later today. I did that all week long. And on Friday afternoon, I've been drinking all morning, and I walked in, and I'll never forget, it was my old location, and we had these pool tables, and we had a beer machine. I worked for a manufacturing plant, and at 4 o'clock, you could drink. And so you just put the money in like you would to get a Coke or whatever, and a beer would come out, right? So all these people were standing around. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, perfect place for an alcoholic to work. And so I go there. Like, I walk in at, like, Friday at 4, like nothing's wrong. And I have not come in all week, and I've been calling and telling him. And I walk right by the pool tables, and he's sitting there, and I'm just walking like I'm going to the other side of the thing, and he goes, hey, Katie. And I come and I go, hey, what's going on? And he's like, you know, and so, you know, he's like, you know, you've been drinking, what's going on? And I said, you know, I'm going to Spain on Monday with my boyfriend, and I'm going to be gone for 18 days or something, and I'm going to be sober when I get back. And he was just like, oh my God, you know. And so he was like, okay, you need to be. And I got back, and this continued for like another, I don't know, year. And some of the last things that were happening was I started drinking bad in the morning, and I went to work, and I passed out in the office. I was on the floor, right across the floor before the bathroom. And somebody came in, and they just, like, stepped right over me. Like, you know, like that, like it was a normal thing. They just said, you know, and they went to Craig, and they said, you know, I think Katie's drinking again. She's on the floor. And he's like, you know, holy cow. So he buzzed the production manager, and they said, you know, get her keys out of her purse. They got my keys because they knew that when I woke up, I was okay, because they didn't want me driving. And so I fought them and argued with them. When I finally got my keys, by the time I got my keys, they had flattened my tire. So my tires are flat. So then I'm like raising hell, and I'm fussing, and I'm threatening. And went this guy, Dan, who's one of the owners now, is just cussing him out, talking horrible about him in the bathroom, and he could hear the whole thing. So he loves the story now. He's like, you were saying I'm the biggest, you know, and just, you know, just saying all this horrible stuff. He's one of the owners. And I was just like, absolutely, you know. And so anyway, what they did is they called my mother, and they said we need to have an intervention. So my mom came up there. with this guy I was dating, and they had an intervention, and they said I had to go to treatment. And so while I'm sitting there at the table, I call up one of the owners, an alcoholic, and I was like, "You're an alcoholic," and they're kicking me on the table. I mean, it was crazy. It was insane. So I went to treatment, and I got out, and I didn't stay sober, but I didn't drink much longer after that. I did drink one more time, and then something happened, and I don't know exactly how to explain it other than I was at Skyland, and I went into a meeting, and I was just beaten down. I was by myself. No one wanted to be with me. I was bloated. I was nasty looking, and I was nasty acting. I mean, you know, I lived by myself, and I was hiding bottles all over the house. I didn't know that the last guy I dated, he found, you know, cocaine under his dresser. His sons found all this alcohol hidden all around the house after I left. I mean, I was just a total disgrace. And so I would come into meetings, and I, you know, a lot of times I drank there. I drank at Biscayne once and passed out there, and they found my phone. And they, I mean, you could have been there, who knows, but they found my phone, and they said, you know, who is this? And they called them to come get me, and some guy I was dating came and got me. And meanwhile, I got my fourth DUI, by the way, on my street. I ran into a parked car on my street going the wrong way, coming home from a bar. And I ended up, which a couple of things funny about that is the airbag went off in my car, and a piece of glass went in my lip. So I had this piece of glass right here in my bottom lip, which is always a reminder. And I used to have a picture of how I looked, which was horrible, in this bowl that I keep on my kitchen counter to look at. And the car I was driving was completely totaled. And then on my arm where the airbag hit me, the airbag logo is a triangle. And it looks just like our triangle. And I showed somebody the other day. You can see it in this. I don't know if y'all can see it from right here, but it goes straight down like that, over like that, and like that. Anybody would see it up close when they see it. But it's a perfect thing. And I remember when I went to Peach, I went to the hospital, and after I got better, I went to detox. And I remember at Peachford, I was looking at that stainless steel mirror because, you know, you can't have anything like glass. And I was looking at myself, and I was like, what a loser I am. I mean, I was probably 7 years ago, I was like 44 years old, and I was an absolute mess. And I had this triangle on, you know, and I was just like, and so I had gone to Skyland. I heard this girl talk, and she kind of looked like me. She had short blonde hair, and she was kind of, you know, whatever, standoffish, bitchy, and I was like, I loved what she had to say. I really connected to it, and so I was like, you know, that's kind of odd. I never did that. And then I went to Peachford like 3 days later, and the girl that was my roommate in treatment came with me, and she knew I'd had trouble. She had picked me up from a bar and dropped me home a couple of times, so she said, I'll meet you at this Peachford meeting. And it was when Fit Tradition was brand new, and they were bringing meetings to Peachford. It was like they'd maybe been in business. They'd maybe been formed a month, and they were sort of bringing stuff to Peachford. And so that same girl was there, and she started talking again. And I was like, God, you know, I totally connected what she said. But when I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, the first time, I did this strictly the way that, you know, some people can do it that way. I know I can't now. But it was like I went to the meetings, and I shared. I took what I wanted, and I left the rest. I mean, if I liked what you said and I liked you, we would go to dinner, or we would go to lunch, we'd hang out. And if I didn't, I didn't go through the book. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't think God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. It was all so ego-driven. And I was so beaten up this time that, what, you know, my friend from treatment said, why don't you ask that girl to be your sponsor? I was like, oh, God, really? I mean, I'd never had one. I'd had one guy as a sponsor of mine the first time around. And after about, you know, people stopped asking me, I didn't go to meetings that people were like, who's your meeting and what step are you on or whatever. It wasn't like that way back then. At least it wasn't for me. I'd probably go, loser, you know, I mean, I was so bad then. And so anyway, I heard that girl share again, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, well, there's a few things you got to do if I'm going to sponsor you. And I thought, oh, God. And she told me some things, and for some reason I did them. I guess I was just willing, you know. And she said, you know, you don't have to be in my home group, but we just formed one. And she said, it's at Barcliff United Methodist Church where they have the pumpkins. And I thought, oh, my gosh, that is like literally, I mean, it's a half a mile from my house. That's where I went to kindergarten. And so I was like, oh, I guess that's a God thing. I guess I could go to the meeting there and try it, you know. And I felt like everybody else feels. I went in. I felt like I didn't fit in. I felt like people were better than me. And I felt like, you know, all this talk about all the steps and the book and the spiritual stuff was not going to work for me. Y'all must not be an alcoholic like me, but I am a mess. And, you know, if you think that this spiritual thing is going to be my solution, I mean, how can that work for me? I mean, you know, I was like downing vodka in the morning, holding my nose, downing vodka, and making myself go to work, and drinking all the way through the night, and waking up not knowing where the pizza came from, or how I got home, or if my car was out there. I mean, I was a blackout drinker every night. But she said, you know, just do a few things. She's like, let's meet once a week, come to our home group, and or join a home group, and I'll take you through the book. I'm like, okay, you know. And so I started doing it, and my life changed. I mean, you know, it's nothing short of that. I mean, it's nothing more than that's all I did. And for someone, you know, it really wasn't that hard. I mean, you know, I still have that sponsor today, and she literally met with me every week, and we went through page by page, and we did the steps when they came out in the book, you know. And she would say to me, you know, after I got some time, I started, like, I think it was right at six months, I was like, I got to chair the group, and I remember I was so excited to chair that meeting on Saturday night, and I was just like, you know, I started having fun in Alcoholics Anonymous again, and I was like, I love this, you know, why did I ever give this up? But I gained this humility, and I started knowing who and what I really was, and that I'm a powerless drunk, and that without a spiritual solution, I'm going to drink again. I mean, I knew down here that I might not ever be able to get sober again, and life was getting to be better again. I mean, you know, I woke up, and I felt good, and I heard the birds. I mean, I used to be like, you know, like, I used to be like, I hated the birds in the morning, those loud birds, and I was hung over, and I was like, you know, God, I hated the birds, and the bright sun, hated it. And then all of a sudden, you know, now I'm a pretty happy person. Now I'm like, I started going, oh, the birds are so nice, and I take my little dog, don't look at the birds, you know, I'm all excited, you know, I was happy again, I was full of joy again. I'm like, you know, the birds are singing, the sky is blue, and my life is good. And I just had none of that when I was drinking. I was such a, you know, I was such a disgrace. Really, I don't think of another word right now, but that home group really kind of changed my life. It was small then, and I remember the very first I joined it. Let's see, my sobriety date's in July, so I joined it probably July the 12th or July. By the end of my last drive was July 4th weekend, and I came to the group on July 12th, and I joined that next time that you could join, and the next time we had elections, which would have been 8 or 9 months later, 7 or 8 months later, I got the fellowship chair. And, you know, I tried to get involved and get service. And since then, you know, I was the treasurer. And then I was, like, speaker chair for a year, which was, you know, trying to find, we have 52 speakers, well, times two, because there's two speakers every Saturday night. And that kept me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And before you know it, my life started getting so good. And about 8 months into the getting sober, I met Trey, and I had got a flat tire at the church where we meet, and I had asked some guys to come change the tire, and Trey was there, and he came up instead of the guys that I called over, and he was like, I'll change this tire, you know, and he got down, and he had a backpack on, and he changed it real fast, and all these other guys were, like, looking in my trunk. They thought that you had to, like, unlock some hubcaps, I don't know what they thought. They were stupid, but, I mean, they didn't understand. They thought they were going to be locked because of the wheels or something, and they're doing all this stuff, and I'm like, who is this guy down here on the ground, and the tire's already off, and they're all still going, where do you think it is, you know? And Trey's got the whole tire off, and he's, you know, putting on the new one. And so anyway, we went to pizza that night, and I remember thinking, I kind of like this guy. I mean, I liked him the first second I saw him, and someone caught me trying to find him, and they said, oh, he's not gone. And I'm like, I've been looking for him. And then I was like, well, how do you know he's not gone? And they go, because his backpack's under the table, and he rode a motorcycle. And I was like, his backpack's under the table. And so the next day he called me, and we started dating, and I remember we ran it by our sponsors, and we didn't have a year. You know, my sponsors, she's like, look, I only follow what's in the book. It's not in the book that you got to wait a year. She's like, I know him, and he's a great guy. He's a free spirit, and he's had a lot of time before, and he only had 4 months, by the way, and I had 8 months. And she said, he's got to run it by his sponsor, and you know, you're through the ninth step with me. She's like, you got my blessing. It's like, okay. So 6 months later, he proposed. And 4 months after that, we were married, and that was 6.5 years ago. Is that right? 5.5 years ago? Is that right? I'm pushing it. 5.5 years ago. Yeah, 5.5 years ago.
I'm off the hook for one.
Yeah, we got married February 5th of 2011. So, and, you know, it's been great. I mean, we're both very active in the program. And, you know, I was 45 years old before I got married the first time. And mostly that's because nobody really wanted to be around me. I mean, you know, my options were open. And I didn't have anybody wanting to be with me. I mean, you know, I couldn't pay you to be with me. And I was willing to. You know, I mean, I had the money, I had the drugs, I had whatever, but people were just like, no thanks. I mean, you know, they were gone. And I was conceited, and I insulted you, and I was a mess. And so, you know, my life started getting better and better and better as I got sober, and you know, I started able to be able to be a good employee for that job that did so many good things for me, and I was able to do steps around the people that I had resentments toward at my work, and I was able to, you know, get through so many hard times. Like, I guess the first thing horrible that happened to me, and not horrible, but the first life thing that happened to me that was tough was my brother had a heart attack. And I was about 4 years sober. He was only 50 years old, and he died on my mom's couch suddenly of a heart attack. And I remember, I was like, you gotta be kidding me, you know? And, you know, everybody stepped up. I remember a bunch of men from our home group were at their Spirit of the Fifth, and they all came home on Saturday without letting me know to go to the funeral and dedicated the little brochure to my brother. Trey was in my life then, was right by my side through all of it, through helping my mom. I mean, my mom, she lived at my mom's house, so for her to find him like that on the couch was just horrible. And he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He would come to our group, he helped babysit. It's a little bit of a lost soul, but I mean, he was my brother, you know, and he died. It was tough. And then last year, a year ago, August, my father died, and he also was one of us, and he had gotten sober, and then he had started drinking again because he was a bad alcoholic, and when you are an alcoholic and you don't have a program, you're going to drink again. It doesn't matter if you're 80 years old and you're in an independent living. Trust me, I've seen it. My little dad and his little walker was able to buy beer at the store and get the Budweiser home. Me and my friend caught him one time when he diarrheaed all over himself. And at this apartment, I had my friend Barbara come with me, and we went over, and they told me I had to come clean him up, and I went over to clean him up because he had done that, and there was cold beer by the thing, and I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. You know, he's an alcoholic all my life, and here he is drinking. But, you know, I went to my sponsor with it, and she said, what do you expect him to do? She said, he can't go to Alcoholics Anonymous. He's, you know, he couldn't get there, and he doesn't have a solution, so of course he's going to drink again, you know. But he was like a, you know, big part of my life, and I respected him very much, and I took care of him, and I was able to be a daughter, which I would never have been able to be before. When I was still drinking and I was taking care of him, I would leave him at the grocery store and I'd go drink, or I would, you know, be like, you know, rude to him and mean to him, like, you know, it was an inconvenience for me to have to take care of him. I think I've even thought and maybe said, you know, if you didn't, you wouldn't have had a stroke if you weren't drinking, and you would have taken your Lasix or whatever it is he should have been taking. He couldn't take it to avoid a stroke because he was drinking. And I was pissed off about it when I, you know, and you know, when I was still drinking. And then when I went through that with my sponsor and I realized, you know, he was an alcoholic, you know, and that's exactly what I would be doing if I didn't have this program and if I hadn't been saved by God. And so I took care of him all the years of his life. I mean, I was the only child that was able to take care of him. My sister is in Florida, and she was not available to for proximity reasons or financial reasons. And that was, you know, came on me. And I looked at it like, this is a gift. I get to do this, you know, and I couldn't have done that before. And it was so wonderful to be able to be there for him. I was the only one there. And I remember a time I said, if it wasn't for me, there would have been nobody that saw him. I mean, he lived in a little place and he'd go and stuff, but there was really no one but me. And yeah, I'm able to be there for my mother now, and she's older and in her later years, and I wouldn't have been able to do that. And that's all because of working the steps in my life and because of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no other reason. You know, last year was the last, you know, big thing. My little Shih Tzu died. I know it sounds crazy to talk about my little Shih Tzu up here, but I mean, he was 15 years old, and I love that little dog, and that was the hardest thing. And Trey had come to love him, and we had to put him to sleep because he had vestibular disease, which was terrible to look at. His ear was on his shoulder, and he was kind of like walking in circles, and it just happened so fast. He went from running one day to having this. And I mean, I was devastated, but it's like I don't have to drink over and eat that stuff anymore. You know, we went through it together, and you know, I went and I, I, you know, we got another little dog who's the love of our life now, you know. And, you know, my life is pretty simple today. I go to work and I try to do a good job. I come home, I see my mom at least. I take my mom every Sunday to church. I see her every once a week. I go over there. I pay her bills. I'm there for her as a daughter, which, you know, I was the one that robbed her of her sleep at night. You know, I remember I made amends to her. You know, what can I do, Mom? I know I've been horrible. You know, what can I do? How can I make this right? She's like, just please don't ever drink again. You're my baby, and I love you so much. Please don't ever drink again. I used to worry about you. I mean, I was in high school one time, and I went to this Hall & Oates concert, and I wandered off, and I was in a blackout and got drunk, and something happened to me, who knows what. I got taken home by a couple of guys at 3 o'clock in the morning. There were fire trucks and police cars up there. I was 16, 17 years old. My parents woken up from asleep. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. They don't know where their daughter is. That's how early it started. And what she tells me to do is just don't drink again and just, you know, and so that's called living amends. But I try to do so much more than that, you know, and I do. I think that I do, and I am able to do that now, and I love it. I mean, I love being able to be there for her. And it's never too much. I mean, I go, I'll pay her bills. I'll help her get in and out of the car. I'll take her trash down. I'll, you know, you know, whatever it is that she needs. I'll cut her watermelon. I go get her watermelon. I, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, I cannot do enough for that woman because of all that she's done for me, and I want to do that, you know. I mean, that's how I, you know, doing for others is how I get out of myself today. And this program has taught me that, you know, everything is about smashing my ego and getting out of self and doing for others. And when I do that, I'm okay. It's when I start thinking about whatever, you know, when I start listening to what's in between here, that's when I have a problem in my life. And I have no problems. I will have to go through, you know, unless something happens to me, it's likely I may have to go through my mother's death, and that's going to be horrible. But I know today that I can get through that because, you know, this program surrounds you. They come to you and they say, you know, what can we do? And let's get together with you on the night that you would, and how can we be there for you? And they, you know, I bring my mom to all kinds of things where you are. You know, Daryl and Pierce are probably coming to Thanksgiving this year. They know my mom, you know. My birthday this year, we took my friend Claire and my husband and me went out to dinner to a fancy restaurant, and my mom's part of that. So they all know that, and that, you know, and they'll be there for me when something happens. And I just feel like I can get through anything today. And what I really try to do is be a good wife and try to help him when he struggles. And we're a good team. I mean, he picks me up all the time and helps me with so much stuff. I mean, I lay a lot of stuff on him all the time. I'm a difficult person to be with. I mean, I listen to him laughing. I like everything to be a certain way. And, you know, you know, I could come in the house and have, you know, everything could be perfect, but he's got, you know, coffee cups out in the back and, you know, a coffee cup up front with some cigarettes and some other stuff, and I'm all over just those two things. Meanwhile, he just rebuilt our bathroom, you know, or whatever, and I forget that stuff until I talk to my sponsor and say, you ain't gonna believe what Trey did today. And I tell her, and she goes, you know, isn't he the one that built that entire basement apartment that you rent out now? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, and he did what? He left his three cigarettes out front. And I'm like, yeah. She's like, yeah, let me tell you what my kids did today and what my husband does. So my husband doesn't lift a finger is what she says. She said, he comes home, he lays on the couch, he does nothing. I said, well, I'd divorce him. I mean, I'm like, I would divorce that man. I mean, I need him to be doing this shit stuff, you know? And so, but I mean, that's how it works today is that you go to, you know, you go to people and you get, you know, it's just a great way of life for me. I try to live this program. So I'm trying to think what else. So let's see. So step one to me is you know, admitting I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life's unmanageable. It's clearly unmanageable when I'm drinking in the morning and, you know, well, that's it. If I'm drinking in the morning, you know, and I've always believed in God, so I turn my thoughts and my actions over to God whenever I realize that I'm taking them back, and He helps me with, you know, I go to God when I'm desperate on my knees, and I say, help me with a certain situation, and it gets better. And the only way I know that is by doing it. I used to be like, that is the stupidest thing I ever heard. But when I'm in enough pain, I get down on my knees, and I'm like, you know, God, you know, take away the you know, obsession to be so, everything to be so perfect and to rest my happiness if only if this would happen, then I'd be happy. I am terrible about that, about saying, you know, if all this stuff would just be right, then I would be happy. I get all that stuff and you're not happy. You know what I mean? If you live like that. I mean, a perfect example is, you know, for a long time, I mean, this is a stupid example, some of y'all, but some of you girls might get it. I was like, I would always say to people that close, my real close friends, I'd be like, you know, I'm so fat, I can't stand, I'm carrying on all this weight, I'd be so happy if I could just get this weight off. And I sounded just like my mother. She says the exact same thing. She's been saying that since I was born. But my mom's like 200 pounds. She's a little heavy. And, you know, and I was always saying it, I'll be happy if. And so then I end up doing something about it, and I gain the weight. I mean, I lose the weight, and I got to the size I wanted, but I wasn't happy. You know, I mean, it was nice. I mean, but it's not sustaining joy. And I was taught that that's just like getting a new diamond ring that's shiny, and the shiny wears off, and that's not sustaining joy. You know, sustaining joy comes from helping others and doing for others. And, you know, and I know that I've changed so much because some of the things that, and I got so much room to grow. I mean, trust me, I'm nowhere near where I need to be, but just little things like I spent way too much money on a car, and I'm telling you, I cannot wait to get rid of this car so I'll have extra money to do things for other people. And to not be so strapped and to be like, you know, putting a strain on our marriage if we're trying to do something like building bigger bedrooms so we can have bigger than a double bed. I mean, we sleep in a double bed with a dog and 8 pillows, me and him. That's insane because we have like an old ranch with this little thing. So I want to build this big bedroom, but I'm like, I'm financially, I'm very, you know, I like everything to be done right. So I'm like, well, I have to get rid of this car and then have the money. And it's like, you know, it's a journey, you know, and I'm not going to be happy when I get that big king size bed either, you know. I'm not going to be happy then. Yeah, he might be. But, you know, it's like, you know, those kind of things. I mean, these are just real life. You know, I mean, I get caught up in my head and I get caught up with things I'm thinking. And I realize that really, you know, I'm happiest when I'm just with my family and I'm with my dearest friends. And, you know, I'm just centered with God, and I'm thankful for all that he's done for me. And I'm not drinking today. You know, I mean, compared to what I was to what I am now, has to be a miracle. There has to be a God to go from the person I was to, you know, someone like me that I don't think about drinking anymore. You know, I used to be like, you know, my car drove into the liquor store. I mean, I was relapsing constantly. I was the girl that could not get sober. And somehow, with the help of God, I put together 7.5 years. I mean, that's only by the grace of God, you know, no other way. And, you know, I still have a sponsor, still call her once a week, still active in my home group. What am I doing else? Let's see, what else am I doing? Oh, what is it? I can't think, but I am doing something. I just can't think of what it is. But anyway, I think that's probably all I have, and I hope that I have illustrated how you can come from a hopeless alcoholic to a person who is not hopeless anymore and that doesn't have to drink and that has a somewhat happy, normal life, and it's all due to Alcoholics Anonymous and God, so thanks.